Well, the world is dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And how are we holding up these days? That seems to be the new question. That is the question that we're all asking each other, and the question we should be checking in with ourselves with. I had some thoughts today. It's been quite a while since I did sort of a deep dive on some introspection. And the introspection that I've had specifically relates to my thoughts on what it's like to be a person with some kind of mental health issues. It's something that I know a lot about as a person with a lot of mental health issues. But again, I have to stress this up front. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a therapist. And any advice that you get from me should be taken with a block of salt. Because these are things that I've observed, that I know. And the idea isn't to give you something that you can wedge into your life as a one-size-fits-all, but more as something to bounce your own ideas off of. It's like a brick wall, and I'm the rubber ball, or the spaghetti. Whichever analogy works for you. But enough about that. I want to get into this. I had some thoughts today. Because today I'm feeling that strange low end mania. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice. I don't know if it's coming through in my demeanor, but my brain feels like it's firing simultaneously too fast and too slow. I'm tired, but I'm wide awake and I'm agitated. I'm angry. But I'm not really angry at anything. I think a lot of people are having these feelings right now and don't really know what to do with them because they haven't had these feelings before. You and me, we might be a little bit different. We've got superpowers in this case. It's really something to be able to look at yourself and look at the way you're feeling and look at all of that and recognize, since it's not going to go away, how do I access it in a healthy way and how do I live with it on a regular basis? How do I live my day-to-day life with me? It's an excellent question to ask yourself, whether you've got any sort of mental health issues or not. We've all got something that we're working on, that we're either ignoring or refusing to change, knowing full well that there's a likelihood that continuing forward will allow all of the negativity and all of the ignorance to consume us. So we've got to do what's in our best interest. And in the case of mental health issues, you've got to be honest with yourself. Whatever that looks like for you. I know for me, I've got to be very, very careful whenever I hit a mania. Because I have a tendency to bite off more than I can chew. I have a tendency to do things irrationally and think that it makes perfect sense at the time. And so when it comes to being in a manic episode, I simply don't trust that my feelings are correct. I check in with them and I use other people as a sounding board It's not a bad idea for you either. But again, this is coming from the person who just said not 5 minutes ago that I don't have any advice for you. All I'm going to say is this. Today on the show, we've got Alison Pena, a.k.a. the Bad Widow. And we talk about a lot of things. She's dealing with quite a lot herself right now, being in New York, the epicenter of trouble at the moment. But we get into all of that. So I'm going to stop talking, and we're going to get into that conversation. Here's Alison. Start here. Hi. Nice to meet you.
Hi.
So, before we were rolling, you were telling me that you're in New York right now, right in the middle of this.
Right in the middle of this.
Jesus. What is the general atmosphere as far as, like, you know, just going out of the house and down to the store to get bread or something?
Well, mostly we don't.
Yeah.
So the streets are empty, and the streets are never empty.
Yeah.
And New York is a city of a lot of sound and noises and, you know, honking and people walking along and talking. And so there's a sort of a base level of sound that exists all the time.
Yeah.
That's gone. It's gone. So the only sounds you really hear are ambulances,
yeah,
sirens. So it's like being in a place and it's fight or flight, but you can't fight it, and there's nowhere to run.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I've never experienced anything like this in my lifetime. I've just never seen anything like this. It's quite different from any other sort of, let's say, even national tragedy, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of touching everybody in some way or another. And, I mean, I go out for small walks around the neighborhood. We're all kind of keeping away from each other. And
yeah.
I just moved. So I'm living in a brand new area, and immediately this hit.
Wow.
Yeah, so... I haven't gotten to know California all that well just yet.
Mm.
But tell me a little bit about before all of this. First of all, where are you from?
New York.
Yeah?
Yeah, I grew up here.
Oh, my God. So you've been through all the changes.
Yeah. Most of my life I've lived here.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up on Park Avenue. My dad was an investment banker.
Mm-hmm.
With a boutique investment banking firm that had been in the family for three generations. And when I was 18, he and his partners sold it to Merrill Lynch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's kind of historical. my mom was... She was an international center of photography and set up their education department
mm-hmm.
There so people can get a master's there for photography. I had three brothers. One of them had a genetic enzyme deficiency and died when I was 25 and he was 23.
Wow.
So I have a brother in California who has a landscaping company.
Nice.
And in San Francisco, his business is not essential. In New York, it is.
Yeah.
So landscaping, construction, so there's a kind of a patchwork of laws at the moment. But his business is not essential, except that they're not enforcing. So he's going out himself to serve his clients because he's one person, but he can't send out his teams.
Yeah.
So that's impacted his business. And because they're not enforcing it, one of his clients was really angry that he was not sending out his teams. And he said, well, but we have an order to shelter in place. What do you want me to do? And she said, well, my son, his crew's out. And so he may lose clients. He's already lost one of his workers.
Yeah.
And you know, if there was nobody doing it, then it would be even-handed, but...
Right. But it's kind of all over the place. I mean, things are... Even with restaurants, I got a lot of friends that are, you know, in hospitality, entertainment even, and nobody's working right now.
Nobody's working.
Yeah. But growing up with a businessman for a father, and then your mother being like a photography teacher, having such a balance of both creativity and business at the same time, what kind of effect did that have on you?
Well, I'm madly entrepreneurial. So I really make I love to work, and I make a lousy employee because I'm always looking to make things better.
Yeah.
So I'm not easily employable, and I like to work. I mean, I love maximizing potential.
Yeah.
And I love empowering, and I love all of this stuff. But it doesn't really fit in with 9 to 5.
You know, it really doesn't. It's funny. It's about twice as hard to put in the effort to work for yourself, if not 4 times as hard, if not 10 times as hard. It's a lot safer and a lot easier to just go to a job.
Well, it is, but at a certain point, that eats your soul.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. It can. I think it depends on the kind of person you are. And if you've got that creativity to you, if you've just got a general drive, let's say, for something that you want to have that's just yours that you created, you know, working your way up the ladder isn't going to work for you. It's probably not.
Yeah, I think it also has something to do with the level of autonomy that you have in that job. So, for example, if you're in something where you can carve out a world that you're just everyone within your orbit thrives.
Yeah.
Even if outside your orbit they may not be thriving, if you can just control a certain number of really self-expressed people who are really living into their zone of genius most of the time. I mean, the fact of the matter is we all do stuff we don't want to do some of the time.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, but if you're 70-30, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, right? I think it really matters to be able to say that you've created something for yourself by the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you actually know quite a lot about making some tough choices and deciding how you're going to spend your time, because you had a pretty rough education in that, from what I know. But take me back a little farther, especially being in New York, a city of that size.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how two people meet each other.
First time or the second time? I'll tell you about how I met my husband, and I'll tell you about how I met, and then I'll tell you about how I found my second love.
Yes.
After my husband died. And so I met my husband. I would never have met him. I was a member of a church, which was Norman Vincent Peale's church, and tend to be more sort of spiritual than super religious. So yeah. Power of positive thinking was like right up my alley.
Sure.
And I was on the leadership committee for singles in their 20s and 30s. And I was like fed up with life. I hated my job. I hated everything. I was just, you know, I was done with men. Above all, I was done with men.
Yeah.
And I went on this church retreat to the Delaware Water Gap. And I complained 2 hours in the car about everything. The poor people in the car, right?
Yeah.
And I got there and my girlfriend said, what you need in your life is a serious relationship. And I looked at her like she was out of her mind. Because I said, have you not been listening to my 2 hours of complaining?
Yeah.
And she said, well, you should talk to that guy. And it was David who became my husband. And I sort of, and later that evening, you know, we were by the Delaware Water Gap and there was a dock. And so I went over to him and I said, well, would you like to sit on the dock and talk? And I'm thinking, you know, we'll see what happens. It's romantic, whatever.
Yeah.
And he said, wow, I'm really looking forward to getting to bed early. And I thought, well, this could be short-lived. So we went down on the dock and there were these two brothers and they knew they were fishing for an eel for their grandmother.
Really?
It was a reunion. And they knew everything about all the fish they were catching. And so it was not romantic at all, but we were just talking and laughing. And we
But it was interesting.
It was interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun. And so then we went and we kept talking and we were kissing and eventually, because I had to lead groups the next day, I was part of the leadership.
Yeah.
I said, you know, we should maybe go to sleep at this point. And he said, or we could go lie on the dock and watch the sunrise. And it was like a bell went off in my head and I knew I would marry him. In that moment.
That easy. Out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere. Now the sequence to that was less easy.
Well, yeah, you got to fight off people catching eels and
right. Exactly. Yeah, his mom was really tough. He was an only son. Mm-hmm. Single mom. Really not interested in competing for his time. She wasn't.
Yeah.
So that was tough. He didn't have any friends. He was a professional artist. He had no friends who were married, pretty much. So he had no experience. So before he asked me, he interviewed people, including taxi drivers, about the pros and cons of marriage.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Anyway, he eventually proposed and he said, you know, I've decided I want to get married. And by this time I was so mad. It was 4.5 years. I said, to me? And he said, yeah, to you. And then it was a bit of a roller coaster ride. He started acting odd and it turned out that he was bipolar.
I'm familiar with that.
Yep. Had never known. And so he had a psychotic break 6 weeks before we got married. Hmm. And I looked at it and I said, I love this man. And I married him.
What was your experience with any mental health issues before that?
He didn't know he was nothing.
Yeah. I mean, had you ever seen anything? Was it ever a conversation in your household growing up?
No.
Just nothing. Just
not in my household. No. So I didn't know anyone who had any mental health stuff, nothing. And, but, you know, I mean, he started, would talk to me very about intimate details of stuff until 4 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, wow, is this what it's like to get married? You know, maybe this is pre-wedding jitters, but I had never been married and he had never been married. I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, I just didn't know. And, you know, he decided he had a studio across town and he decided he needed to go and paint the pipes at 5 o'clock in the morning. So it was like this weird stuff was happening.
Yeah. Mania.
Weird stuff.
Yep.
And eventually I said, you know, we need help. I don't know what's happening, but we need help. And I talked him into going to see a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And I always knew he would never harm me.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're in the psychiatrist's office and he puts his hand in his pocket and he says, I have a gun. And I know he doesn't have a gun.
Right.
And I know he'll never hurt me. So I'm blocking the door. The psychiatrist is flipping out. Absolutely flipping out. Get out of his way. And you know, pulled me away from the door. He ran out. I went to find him. And he wound up in the hospital, you know. I talked him into going back. We rang the bell. The psychiatrist by this time, I think, was just completely freaked out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, 3 police cars and 4 ambulances or something. And that was my first experience of that. And then I decided to marry him anyway. The biggest mistake I made in our marriage was that his mom said to me, oh, we don't need to tell anybody about this, do we?
Yeah. Yeah, that's always an interesting choice.
Yes.
When the family decides they want to preserve something, I suppose. I'm not really sure what it is they think they're... What it is they think they're doing by right. adding a shame component to it, but it doesn't help anyone.
Doesn't help anyone, and the stupidest thing I ever did was agree to that.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think with at least some level of hindsight, I'm sure it's easy to see what kind of a mistake it was. But I also think that it wouldn't necessarily be that difficult to figure out how to forgive yourself for it because. You can start reasoning out why you may have thought that was the right idea at the time.
Well, I mean, what it did in terms of my experience is that it cut me off. I have a really robust network of support, and it cut me off from my entire network.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. I mean, I told nobody for 2 years.
Wow. So that must have been like a bombshell when you finally did have to tell someone.
Well, I told someone because he was in Provincetown and he was painting on his own. Mm-hmm. And he was with his mom and he had forgotten his meds. And I asked her to please stay with him because I could hear his voice starting to slow down. I knew at that point. When it was going bad, right?
Yeah.
You know, you get a knowing where you know when it's okay and when you know when it's turning.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I could hear it was turning. And I said, you know, can you stay? And she said, no, I've got to come back and go to work. And she left. And I hopped a bus and started heading up there, but he was a distance away. And, you know, sent the meds, overnight or whatever. And they stopped me. They pulled me off the bus and they said, are you so-and-so? Get off the bus. Your husband is being taken to the hospital. and he had sucked down the contents of a fire extinguisher and walked off the pier.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's, it's unbelievable, but at the same time, it, you know, I start thinking about that, because that's a sentence I don't think many people ever say in their lifetime with those string of right. words. But being a bipolar person myself, I can mm-hmm. say that a lot of times when you're in the thick of that, you will do things that seem to make a lot of sense to you at the time.
Right.
And yeah, I think in a weird way, I kind of do understand it.
And in all honesty, if I had been there, I might have been able to ground him. But because I wasn't, I couldn't.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't do it long distance. And so then, you know, that was that. But that time when his mom said, "We're going to keep this a secret, aren't we?" I said, "Oh, no." And it got in the paper, you know, it got in the newspaper and all that. So anyway, we had a marriage that was really wonderful and really a roller coaster. You know, there was the bipolar, and then he became diabetic. And then, so I call myself Allison Penna, a.k.a. Bad Widow. And in October 2015, my husband was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer.
Yeah.
And basically the trajectory for that is, okay, you've got 6 weeks to 4 months to live. If you don't have your affairs in order, hop to. I mean, it really is like that.
Yeah.
And we decided to do it a different way, because the doctors were saying, slow down, stop doing things. You know, you have to conserve your strength. You have to. And we decided to live full tilt boogie till the end.
Yeah.
So we were together for 25 years. We missed our 20th anniversary by 3 weeks. But in the course of I created an environment where he loved to work. He was an artist. He adored working. And so he finished his last watercolor commission the Thursday before he died.
Oh, wow. But how amazing is that, to have that exist in the world?
Yep. And I made sure, you know, I literally was calling his friends up and saying, get your butts up here and be here, because otherwise you're going to miss it.
Yeah.
And so I made sure that he had friends coming and talking to him about art in the weeks before he died. And I literally was like, if you don't get yourself here now, he will be dead and you will miss it. I mean, I was that blunt.
Yeah. I think you kind of have to be.
Yeah. And some did and some didn't. You know, I mean,
and why do you think that is? Is that, do you think it was fear or denial?
I think people are terrified about mortality.
Sure.
Scared to death to die. I mean, the thing that's a little bit ridiculous about that is everybody dies.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the funny right? thing is, it's a thing that we only ever experience through seeing it from the end of the person who watches someone else die. Because we don't have any idea what's going to happen to us. We all have thoughts. We all have hopes. But as far as death is concerned, it's going to happen to all of us.
Yes.
So to take that into account and decide that rather than prolong and go for the longest stretch possible by playing it as safe as possible,
yep.
You chose the bravery route, which was let's actually live as hard as we can and as full as we can for whatever time we can.
Yep.
Where do you get that kind of bravery from?
Well, I mean, there's a real fearlessness that happens when you're literally, we say, what would you do if tomorrow was the last day of your life?
Yeah.
And for us, one tomorrow pretty close was going to be the last day of our lives together, like for real.
Yeah.
And my husband was 6'3". He was 267 pounds. And by the end, he was 146 pounds.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't put any weight on him because I would crush him.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was weird and awful and wonderful. And, you know, it was really a lesson in living fearlessly, because if you're looking at that and you're witnessing that and experiencing that, what is there to fear, really?
Yeah.
And on my bucket list, I wanted to speak about what I talk about and sing in cabaret shows. I had sung in gospel choirs for, you know, over a decade.
Yeah.
But like as part of a choir. And I was like, I want to be part of a group cabaret show. And in the time he was dying, I was in two.
So he got to see that.
He got to see the first one. The last one was the Tuesday before he died.
But even still, he got to watch you pursue that and make that happen, and actually got to watch you do it once.
Yep.
That's pretty amazing too.
And like pushed me out the door. And for me, it was the only way I knew how to stay whole through this whole thing. Because in some moment, I was going to be a widow. And I had no idea what that meant. As I had no idea what it would be to marry a man who was bipolar. I mean, you can prep some things. You can like pull the finances together. But the reality of this stuff is inconceivable.
What was your relationship with chaos before all of this happened? Do you handle change pretty well?
I like deconstructing things and making them work better. I just do. Like, I'd rather break something that's broken and make it better than keep working with something that's really dysfunctional. I mean, that's how Bad Widow came to be.
Yeah. Tell me about Bad Widow.
Well, Bad Widow is about really taking the unconventional road. It's about, like, when Dave was dying, so he lived 11 months, so our living fearlessly worked really well for us. The oncologist said, whatever you're doing, keep doing it.
Yeah.
Keep doing it, because I'm convinced he would have lived less long if he hadn't been doing all that he loved as much as he could until the end. So at the very end, I got a lot of pushback about, we wanted, if it was at all possible, for him to die at home with just me. And in the end, I was holding him in my arms, and he said, you know, will you take care of my mom, and will you take care of this, and will you take care of that? And I'm like, yes, 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 yes. And I said, in a body, you need breath and love. And outside a body, all you need is love. So when you're ready, go out on the love. And I was literally holding him in my arms, and he took four breaths and went out on the love.
Wow.
That's it.
How do you manage to put everything back into a day-to-day context after living with something so large, so important? You know what I mean? It's like going through a large trauma with someone, and then you have to wake up in the morning and, you know, make some eggs and, you know, take a shower, go to work. You have to make plans for yourself. You have to get used to certain things being tedious, waiting in line at the grocery store. How do you live a life? How do you get yourself back on? It's like going to the moon.
Well, I mean, that took a long time. Like I was with one man for 25 years and then I was a widow.
Yeah.
And you know, my husband's an artist. He left me 800 paintings.
Oh, wow.
The whole place I live is filled with his legacy of work. And so it was more than, you know, sticking his papers in a file.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was a studio that was extra expense in New York. It was half an income. It was, you know, memory gaps. Someone could make an appointment with me, and within a second I would forget. I put baskets of power bars all around my apartment because when I remembered I was hungry, I had maybe 2 minutes to get to the kitchen before I forgot again.
Wow.
Yeah. My best friend put a note by the door. It said, keys, coat, shoes. Because one time I got halfway down the block and I realized I was in my slippers, and I only knew I was in my slippers because the backs of my heels were cold. But there's a real like disconnect.
Yeah.
From everything. And so I started, I like deconstruct things and fix them. And so I started identifying where my gaps were. You know, I felt massively ineffective. I'm a pretty competent, you know, efficient person. And
yeah.
And I couldn't get anything done. My energy was massively variable. I would wake up in the morning and there was the second, especially for almost the first year, there was the second before I woke up. And I knew he was alive. And then there was the second when I woke up and he was dead again. Every day. Every day. That raw. And so Bad Widow came about because there was no one speaking from that raw place.
Yeah.
You needed a
vessel for all of these things.
I needed someone who was willing to say how utterly awful it was. And also to correct all the assumptions that people made. And those are so relevant right now. So what happens when you become a widow is, or what happened for me, let me speak for myself, but I've talked to others and it's like this for them too, is that I felt like I was broken and people treated me like I was broken.
Yeah.
And so in my life, people's stepped up, stepped back, or stepped out and vanished because they couldn't handle the wasteland of my grief. And widows are clunky. It's like someone would say, how are you? And I would just snap back because my thought was, how the freak do you think I am?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, get a grip. And they would say, what can I do for you? And my thought was, bring back my husband. Because in fact, there was no other thought that I could hold. Like I didn't actually know what someone could do for me.
Yeah. It can be really difficult in a moment of when you're in that place. It can be really difficult to be the person who is forgiving to the people around you who are stumbling around
yep.
how to behave.
Exactly. And so part of what Bad Widow was, what I realized was that there were a lot of people around who loved me and wanted to support me. And they were terrified to say or do something wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I started educating them. I said, well, if you're, instead of asking, how are you, which is impossible,
yeah,
ask, how are you right now? How are you today? And right now, in this time with coronavirus, those are good things to know. Shorter time frame.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ask in a shorter time frame. You know, the other thing that I said was, here's what you need to do with someone like me who doesn't know what you can do for them. Talk to them and listen to what they say. Make a suggestion of doing something based on what you heard, and then execute asking for guidance as needed.
I think that having a general level of being able to listen when someone is speaking really goes a long way for just about any situation in life.
Yeah.
But it's especially important when you're dealing with a person who's been through some, or and is continuing to go through a serious tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there are a lot of things that people think they know. So given that people experienced me as broken, they kept trying to give me their guidance about what I should do next.
Right, because it's all about the fix. It's all about getting as far away from what just happened as possible.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, why can't you get back to work? So one of the things that I did for work was I was a medical editor and proofreader. Now, I couldn't remember. I kept losing information. I couldn't remember anything. I could lose 10 minutes, 1 minute. I could lose a week. I mean, it was really bizarre. It made me feel completely psychotic.
Yeah.
Like I was totally crazy. And there wasn't actually a way to describe what this was like, that this was really happening. This was not in my head. This was my real experience, and I was acting into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody can tell you that your reality is not your reality.
Right, exactly. And then the energy was, sometimes I had lots of energy, sometimes I had no energy. So I knew I had to get back to work, but I also knew I couldn't do like brain work because I couldn't remember a single thing.
Yeah.
So the first thing I did was I had a friend who was a widow who had a Halloween pop-up store. And so, so I went from brain work to hanging up costumes 4 hours a day. That's all I had.
Yeah.
Was 4 hours. And then I was exhausted at the end of it. And then it grew from there. So my aim as I kept growing was let me push out to my boundaries and then let myself rest there and then push out further.
And so where are you getting these things from as you're experiencing this? Are you looking for assistance in some books or on the internet, or do you have a therapist, or are you getting advice from people? What is your source of information on how you're choosing to go through and get yourself back on track at this point?
Really, I couldn't find anything that matched my own experience.
Yeah.
Not
it's
really.
Tough when that's the case.
Well, because my mode of being is raw, vulnerable, transparent. So I was talking about this stuff absolutely clearly from exactly where I was without sugarcoating it or saying I'm fine. You know, I would go to a holiday party and I was bursting into tears at random times. And I would say, look, in the course of this time, I might cry, burst into tears. I'm okay. You don't have to do anything. And then it just handled it. You know, because they knew I had no expectation of them trying to fix me.
Yeah.
And I was okay. So I really, it was just going through and hitting these horrible, you know, running out of energy, crying at random times, being super irritable. I had a year when I was awash in grief. And then I had another period of time when I could go from zero to rage in about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
For no reason. And none of it was under my control. And I tried to warn people, and they didn't actually understand that that this was just like waves in the ocean. You know,
well, you had just gone through this massive thing that forced you to confront a new version of reality. And
right.
So you were already, in a way, kind of rewiring yourself for the very idea that you were going to have to be completely open to whatever is coming next.
Yes. Yes. And the way that I really helped myself and healed myself is by being vulnerable and by sharing this experience absolutely authentically and by having it reflected back. You know, I got a note from someone who said, oh, now I understand why I haven't been able to heal from my grief of 40 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and so I started getting reflected back that my reality was not bonkers. It was actually something that other people had experienced as well. And so the way that I did it was I kept looking at the places I was knocking up against, not knowing what to do, and creating nets. So I made stuff to fix what I needed to handle, like get back to work, get back to and eventually I decided, you know, the biggest barrier and the hardest thing was being willing to dare to love someone again.
But tell me about that.
Yeah. That was tough. I have a husband. You know, my husband left not of my choice. And this is the experience of every widow that I've ever met. And so the experience is grief, not anger, right? Anger pushes away. Grief, you don't quite know what to do with that. So I had been with this man for 25 years. My skin only knew his skin.
Yeah.
So I was only accustomed to an arm going around my waist the way his did. To his height versus my height.
Yeah.
But I knew that if I was going to dare to love again, that I needed to push through my own fears and barriers and boundaries and feeling of betrayal and feeling of grief, that I dare to seek love again. That I dare not to, you know, live my life alone because that was it.
Yeah.
And it was inconceivable that I would ever be intimate with anyone again. But I decided, okay, I want to start doing things with men. Like just start pushing. My whole strategy is push the boundaries. You know, what works, what doesn't work. What works, what doesn't work. So a lot of what I started doing was making distinctions. What kind of activities do I like? What kind of people do I like? What kind of... You know, and I decided to do it on Bumble, a dating app.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the last time I had dated was 1992.
Yeah, a little while ago.
Enough said, right?
Yeah. That was before everybody had a computer in their pocket.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was way out of practice. And what I decided to do was to write my profile and not worry about the other person. My intent was to describe who I was and the kinds of things that I liked so clearly that the people who are my people would know it and come to me.
Yeah. Not worrying about necessarily finding your people, but having your people find you.
Exactly. And the context for my dating was I am looking for my next epic love affair. So I was not saying they have to have blue eyes, they have to have dark hair, they have to be this height, they have to – none of that.
Right.
The context was I'm looking for my next epic love affair. And that was what went through everything. And so I wrote my profile, and it said things like, prefer rocky beaches to sandy ones. So in other words, if your thing is the Jersey Shore, you're not my guy.
Yeah.
Right? But I'm not rejecting anyone. It's just this is my clear preference. So if it's not right. yours...
Keep sailing.
No, keep sailing. You know, but no harm, no foul.
Right.
Nothing wrong with anybody. And so I wrote my profile. I got started talking with people. I was terrified. So for a while, the only guys I liked were about 4 hours away.
Well, you know, that's an adventure.
Right, exactly. And it was 2018. It was almost 2 years after my husband died. And so I decided to start meeting men and going out with them. And I reached out to this one guy and I said, well, it's a really hot day, so I'm going to go to this movie or that movie. And would you like to get together one day? And he wrote back and he said, let's go to one of the two movies I had said, and let's have one day be today. And I thought, okay. Well, you know, clearly he was willing to do what I wanted to do. And
that's step one.
Step one, listened.
Yeah.
You know? And then he just kept rising to the surface. You know, he just kept, I was a hot mess. Absolutely a hot mess. I couldn't trust my own instincts. So, you know, there would be times I was still very, you know, get away from me. I kept hitting these anniversaries. And in those days, I could not be touched.
Yeah.
At all. And that, so I would say, get away. And then I would explain, you know, and I think the moment I really fell in love with him was it was maybe our wedding anniversary or something. And I'd been crying all day and I had a date with him and I thought, you know, I really want to go on this date and I've been crying all day. So who wants this? You know, who's going to be willing to handle this? Because I didn't know how I was going to be that night.
Right. Sometimes you just don't.
Sometimes you just don't. And what I decided to do was to trust that he was an adult, able to make his own decision. And I called him up and I said, look, I have been crying all day. I do not know how I'll be tonight. I would like to see you, but are you up for this? Can you deal with this? Because I don't know how I'm going to be. And he said, yeah, that's okay. I can do that. And I really think that's the moment I truly fell in love with him.
That's great.
Yeah. And then I said, and further, I'm okay. Even if I cry, I'm okay. So I need you not to fix me. Try to fix me, because otherwise I'm going to get mad. I'm going to get angry at you. He said, oh, okay. And he said it was a big relief.
Yeah.
You know?
Because we are kind of wired that way with the way that we're conditioned to treat each other when we see another person in a certain state.
Yes.
It's not so much that it's engaging with our empathy, but it's engaging with something else. Because if it was just empathy, I think we would act a lot differently than we do. Which typically, yep. Like you said, the idea is someone crying is a problem to be solved.
Yes.
Not someone crying is someone experiencing something. And they may need to cry. They may need to cry more than anything right now. They may need someone to stand here while they cry.
And just witness.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really comes down to paying attention, having your eyes open, being with the person that you're with in the moment that you're with them, and thinking about them, not thinking about how you should be reacting to them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's yep. not the way that most people operate.
Right.
I do see that. I think that kids these days are figuring that out more and more, which is a good sign. You know, for as much as they, do their annoying things that kids do, totally. I think that every generation it seems to get a little better, and they'll probably be better about all of this than we were.
Oh, I think that's true. And I think one of the interesting things about this coronavirus time is that the people who are good at being are handling it better than the people who are good at doing.
Yes. Oh,
so completely. It's interesting times, right?
Yeah. I'm a day walker because I do a little of both.
Right.
And right. I imagine you do too. I mean, you're an entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, how do you manage in a time of self-isolation?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing. So like everything, I made a net. I laid out all of the things that are part of my life that I love. And I put them down on a board, literally a paper board with Sharpies and stuff.
Yeah.
Because I like them big. And I get up in the morning and I check in with myself and see what I'm up for today.
It's pretty valuable to see it physically in front of you, right?
It is. I mean, I like it. And really, in this moment, this is rough. I mean, I'm in New York City. Yeah. As of today, there are 75,000 cases, 1,500, over 1,500 dead, and I live opposite of hospitals. So this sound yeah. that I hear all the time is sirens.
Yeah.
And it takes a visceral toll, you know, being discouraged from going outside much. It's really rough.
Yeah.
Really rough.
They say whatever you want about people being good at being on their own, but there's stretches of it where it can get unhealthy. As human beings, even if you're an extreme introvert, you've got to have some kind of human contact, or you'll wither. That's just science.
Absolutely, and so we're being forced to find new ways to do that. So I go to an open mic. One of the best ways to move emotions through my body was singing.
Yeah.
And the emotions themselves were not an issue. They were getting them stuck was.
Yeah.
So grief, anger, fear, none of it's an issue unless it stays. And so singing was a big way that I did that. So I've done more cabaret shows, and I go to open mic once a week, and at this one particular place in Manhattan. And we're missing each other so much. We're like family.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I decided to do was on Monday, I opened up my Zoom and threw it out to the group and said, whoever wants to come in, check in, talk, sing, whatever, come on in. I'm opening this every Monday so we can be together. And not a huge number of people came out. There's probably 50 or 60 who go to that place sure. every Monday.
Yeah.
But 10 did.
Hey, that's 10.
And it'll grow. And it'll grow.
The first rule of performing is you perform whether there's one or a million people. You perform yep. the same way. You give it all you got.
Exactly. But this, you know, we have a family Zoom every week now. My mom is in a retirement community. That place is locked down.
Yeah, I imagine. That's got to be pretty scary.
It's really, really tough. I mean, I see her often. After my husband died, so I started writing Bad Widow. I started writing poetry. I started singing before and after. And so my mom and I do open mic poetry together.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Still finding a way to make art, your mom.
She is.
That's pretty amazing.
She's a rock star. She's a rock star. But her intent right now is how do we connect people one to another? Because in a community like that, first of all, they're super vulnerable. And second of all, there are a lot of widows and widowers.
Yeah.
So if they're locked in their apartment, they're locked in their apartment alone. And they're not tech savvy.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, trying to get everyone on Zoom or FaceTime or Skype or whatever so that we can connect with each other. You know, be a resource for each other. You know, there are so many little ways that people can be of service.
Yeah.
You know, this the way that I share and the way that I talk about all this stuff, this is one of the ways I contribute in the world. But for example, my Peapod and all these services that deliver food, they're 2 or 3 weeks behind.
Yeah.
So my stepfather went to try and find a delivery date at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And I was talking to a friend, and turns out she's going to be driving down there after she goes shopping, and she'll shop for them. And she'll drop off the groceries. And that's, like, this is horrible, being in New York right now. And also in this moment, there's these moments of, you know, I have a few friends who've caught coronavirus and gotten through it.
Yeah.
They're like, I'm good. Whatever you need, I'll do it. So there's these sparks of incredible humanity coming out. You know, I see the horror because I, you know, look and deconstruct and fix. This is my thing, right?
Yeah.
And then I also see that the rivers are clearing up and the skies are clearing up and all these things that we said couldn't happen. Well, we can't use less gas.
Right. Guess what? Yeah, absolutely. You know,
well, we can't all work from home. Guess what?
It looks, you know, like a lot of us can.
Yeah, and what possibilities does that open up?
Like, I don't think things are going to be the same after this. I think a lot of change is going to happen.
And that's exciting.
It is exciting. I was talking to somebody the other day who said something that really surprised me. And he asked me, what do you love about this? Because there's a lot of negative and there's a lot of things to hate. There's a lot of things to be upset about and be afraid of. But yep. The way that we talk to ourselves and the language that we use to describe our reality effectively help us put a name and a label on our reality. And so if you start thinking about, yes, all of this is awful, but what do you love about it? Find where the love is. Find the positive. Challenge yep. yourself with that. And he asked me, what do you love about coronavirus? And I really had to think about that question. It was a pretty difficult thing to answer. But I think we're yep. all starting to find our own ways to answer that question.
Yeah, I think we have to.
Yeah, we do.
I think we have to. And I think that the valuing, so typically what gets valued in the workplace, and one of the things that I, and I know we're getting close to time, but one of the things that I'm most passionate about is this idea that we can't be broken by our circumstances.
Yes.
So I'm not broken because I'm a widow. Somebody's not broken because they got divorced. Somebody's not broken because they lost a job. And my biggest concern about this whole thing is this pervasive assumption that we can be broken by circumstances. And right. I believe it to be a lie.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, you're a New Yorker. I mean,
I'm a New Yorker.
Look what happened in New York after 9/11.
Yep.
I mean, of course everyone mourned. Of course everyone was afraid. But there were people out the next day. What can we do to help? How can we figure this out?
Well, and there were candlelight vigils in the park.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be part of one. And my husband's studio was opposite Union Square Park. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, do you have a candle? He said, no, I don't have a candle, but I have a candelabra. So he gave me his candelabra with three candles in it.
Sure.
And I took it in my hand and went out into the park. And there were photographers out there. And one of them said, you know, can I take a picture of your candles? And I said, yeah. And a couple of years later, I saw my hand and the candelabra in an art show.
Wow.
Yeah. It was cool.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing cool. the way that we all impact each other's lives in ways that we didn't necessarily think.
Yep.
And that's why it really does matter, like you said, to listen and be present.
Yep. And the rise of those people with the internal resourcefulness and the valuing of them. Because when you look at the workplace, the people who are valued are the get stuff done.
Yeah.
Not the people who do the nurturing, not the people who can allow people to thrive. Those aren't the ones that get valued and that get the big bucks. So in this moment, those two sets of people are more valuable than the doers.
Yeah.
Those people who can just hold space for all the emotions flying around. Those people who can see the horrors and the possibilities. I mean, that last 11 months with my husband were the most horrible and the most amazing months of my life together.
Yeah. You went to the moon.
I did. And, you know, I didn't come out unscathed, but we don't.
No, of course not. But that's not the point. The point isn't right. to come through everything all right. I mean, the point is really just to live and have a certain level of acceptance. And hopefully, whatever it is you've been through, you can pass that on for other people, for them to be able to do what they're going to do with it.
Right. And be willing to just press up against our own barriers and then let it be. Like, let ourselves rest there for a minute and then keep going.
Yeah.
Then just keep going. You know, because when I was dating my boyfriend, I couldn't trust my own instincts, because sometimes I would feel revulsion because it felt like such a betrayal of my husband. And I had to ask myself, is it me, is it him, or is it us? Because if it was me, I had to handle me.
Yeah.
If it was him, we had to communicate. If it was us, it was for us to sort.
Right.
But making that clear distinction made such a difference and gave us such an incredible communication foundation. Because I wasn't laying off my stuff on him. And it would have been easy. I mean, I'm a widow.
Yeah.
But I'm a bad widow. So it's not how I do things.
Right. Well, I you may be a bad widow, but you're a great conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks for talking to me today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Are you inspired to live? I don't know about you, but I am really inspired and lit up to live after listening to her story. And if you want to get some more of her story in your life, and I know that you do, you can find Allison at badwidow.com, the blog to end all blogs. It is a fantastic read. You have to go through it. It will really change your life. You'll find out some things about yourself that you didn't think you knew. And that's all I got for this week, everybody. Stay safe out there. Take care of yourselves. There are a lot of people that you may not know that could be immunocompromised or just otherwise having a rough time. Let's not make it worse for anybody out there, including ourselves. And as always, don't kill yourselves out there.